This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Alert, radio for people who want to change the world. I'm Ashley Titterton.
And I'm Michael Welch. On today's program, we will explore the role of social networking technology in this spring's federal election with the Toronto Star's own Antonia Zabricius. And speaking of the election, we will speak with Quebec-based commentator Pierre Baudet about the rising fortunes of the NDP and the implications for the future of federal politics. And Stéphane Christophe will bring us a special interview with Patrick Bond on the mobilization against the UN Climate Summit in Durban.
First, the Alert headlines for the week of April 28th, 2011.
According to the latest poll from Ecos Research, the NDP is rapidly outdistancing the Liberals and has whittled the Conservative lead to single digits, a level of support that could see Jack Layton win up to 100 seats on May 2nd. Under that scenario, the NDP would still come in second in seat count to the Conservatives, but the support of the third-place Liberals would give Mr. Layton a working majority in the House of Commons. The Ecos poll, conducted from April 22nd to April 24th, gave the Conservatives 33.7% support nationally. The NDP had 28% support. The Liberals, 23.7%. The Green Party, 7.2%. And the Bloc Québécois, 6.2%. If those numbers held true on Election Day, it would be the worst showing in the history of the Liberal Party and the best result by far for the NDP.
A 500-page dossier of potentially damaging remarks by Stephen Harper, prepared by the Conservatives, has hit the election campaign. The thick binder of material obtained by the Liberals is a treasure trove of controversial Harper quotes listed alphabetically by subject matter. It covers everything from abortion to Western alienation and dates as far back as the 1980s. The file includes the statement, "I'm not ashamed to say that, in caucus, I have more pro-life MPs supporting me than supporting Stockwell Day." There's also his 1995 assertion that, quote, "providing for the poor is a provincial, not a federal responsibility."
A coalition of pro-choice groups says women's rights may be at risk if Stephen Harper's Conservatives win a majority government. The group said Canadians should look at the Conservatives' actions rather than Harper's reassurances the party wouldn't reopen the abortion debate, and pointed to comments last week by Conservative candidate Brad Trost, the incumbent in Saskatoon Humboldt. Trost said the government defunded Planned Parenthood because of pressure from groups opposing abortion. Carolyn Egan, a spokeswoman for the Ontario Coalition for Abortion Clinics and the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, said the most striking example was when the government decided last year not to provide funding under the G8 maternal health program for groups that offer abortions to women in developing countries. Egan said the groups aren't asking people to vote strategically, but to vote for anyone other than a Conservative candidate.
The Department of National Defense says it's been told the unit price of the F-35 stealth fighter will be higher than the $75 million it planned for, but the military insisted it can still deliver the program on budget. The Pentagon, in a recent report to the U.S. Congress, outlined a laundry list of cost increases in the $382 billion U.S. development of the advanced fighter bomber. For weeks, the Harper government has insisted it will pay around $75 million for each F-35 and furiously rejected criticism from Kevin Page, the parliamentary budget officer, who estimated in March that the sticker price for the radar-evading plane would be more like $148 million apiece. The acknowledgement of the price change came as another American report suggested the cost of operating the jets could be billions of dollars more than expected.
The whistleblowing website WikiLeaks has begun releasing thousands of secret documents from the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. The documents reveal the Bush and Obama administrations knowingly imprisoned more than 150 innocent men for years without charge. In dozens of cases, senior U.S. commanders were said to have concluded that there was no reason for the men to have been transferred to Guantanamo. Among the innocent prisoners were an 89-year-old Afghan villager and a 14-year-old boy who had been kidnapped. Some men were imprisoned at Guantanamo simply because they wore a certain model of Casio watches, which had been used as timers by Al-Qaeda. The documents also reveal that the journalist Sami Al-Haj was held at Guantanamo for 6 years, partly in order to be interrogated about his employer, the Al Jazeera News Network.
Syria's crackdown on anti-government protesters is intensifying. At least 20 people have died so far in the city of Daraa after thousands of troops backed with tanks opened fire on protesters. Syria has also sealed off its border with Jordan. On Sunday, at least 13 civilians were shot dead in the town of Jableh, and at least 112 people were killed in Syria last Friday in the deadliest day since anti-government protests began last month. The Wall Street Journal reports the Obama administration is drafting an executive order to freeze the assets of senior Syrian officials.
Thousands of demonstrators gathered in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul on April 24th to protest any extension of U.S. military presence in the country. The protesters also denounced corruption and pressed for the release of detainees. The U.S. military is due to exit Iraq by December 31st, but secret talks have begun to allow the United States to stay longer. Demonstrators loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have vowed to escalate military resistance if U.S. forces do not leave by year's end.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy is due to meet Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to discuss tensions over migrants from North Africa. Italy has angered France by granting visas to thousands of migrants, allowing them to travel across Europe's border-free zone. About 25,000 migrants have arrived in southern Italy so far this year. Rome has called for EU help with their care. Many of the migrants are Tunisian and want to join relatives in France. The unrest in North Africa has triggered a huge movement of migrants to Europe.
A declaration signed by dozens of prominent Israeli academics, writers, and artists welcoming a Palestinian state on the basis of Israel's 1967 borders was presented last Thursday at the site of Israel's 1948 Proclamation of Independence. As the well-known Israeli actress Hana Maron, who lost a leg in a Palestinian attack, read out the declaration outside Tel Aviv's Independence Hall, protesters heckled the gathering, calling the participants traitors. The declaration, which was issued in expectation of moves to recognize a Palestinian state at the United Nations in September, asserts that the end of Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is a fundamental condition for the liberation of both peoples, for the fulfillment of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and for the independence of the State of Israel. The approximately 60 signatories to the document titled The Declaration of Independence from the Occupation included 17 recipients of the Israel Prize, the country's highest honor.
Those are the alert headlines for the week of April 28th, 2011. Now for Around the Left for the week of April 28th, 2011.
Election Day is Monday, May 2nd. If you haven't already, remember to exercise your democratic right and cast your ballot. To find out where, when, and how to vote, visit elections.ca.
Canada and the European Union are negotiating a new Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, which they hope to sign by the end of the year. But it would be more accurate to call it a privatization and deregulation pact. On April 29th, come to Canadian Communities Not For Sale to learn more about the threat CETA poses to Canadian communities and how you can get involved in stopping it. This free event features Maud Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians, and Paul Moist, National President of the Canadian Union of Public Employees. It will take place at the Westin Hotel Calgary in the Ballroom and will begin at 7:30 p.m. Check out the Facebook event for more details.
The Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee has launched an international campaign to stop the Jewish National Fund and strip it of its official charity status. The JNF is instrumental in dispossessing indigenous Palestinians from their land, preventing Palestinian citizens of Israel from owning or leasing over 90% of land in Israel, and literally covering up ethnically cleansed Palestinian villages by planting trees on top of and around the land. To sign the JNF call for action and to find out about more opportunities to stop the JNF, go to www.stopthejnf.org.
May Day is fast approaching, and this year will be the day before a federal election. In Ottawa, meet at Parliament Hill at 1 o'clock p.m. and join national and district labor organizations to demand an accountable government for deteriorating wages, working conditions, benefits, and pensions. A rally organized by No One Is Illegal Toronto will start at 1 o'clock p.m. with a march to follow. Meet at the corner of Queen and Jameson in Toronto to defend worker rights and demand status for all. In Winnipeg, meet at City Hall at 1 o'clock p.m.
The MayWorks Festival of Working People and the Arts will take place this year from May 7th to May 15th at various locations in Toronto. Festival highlights include a labor history walking tour called Mapping Our Work on May 8th and the launch of the Stop Wage Theft campaign on May 13th. For more information about MayWorks events in your city, visit www.mayworks.ca.
The third conference on the impact of Canadian mining on local communities throughout the world is set to take place May 6th through 8th in Toronto. Mining Injustice, Confronting Corporate Impunity will feature several keynote speakers and workshops organized along themes of gendered violence, militarization, Indigenous perspectives, labor rights, and environmental effects. The conference will be held at Sydney Smith Hall, room 2117 at the University of Toronto. For more information, go to the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network's website at solidarityresponse.net.
Socialism 2011, Their Crisis, Our Solutions, is an international educational conference that will be taking place in Toronto at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, room 2212, from May 19th to May 22nd. The conference will feature a variety of discussions and speakers, including Khaled Muammar, president of the Canadian Arab Federation, Barbara Jackman, a renowned Canadian lawyer, Jamie Gonzalez, Organization Secretary of the LUS, or the Socialist Unity League in Mexico. For more information, visit www.socialistaction-canada.blogspot.com.
The Rebels feminist movement is inviting all young women between 14 and 35 years of age to the second Pan-Canadian Young Feminist Gathering. This gathering is a great opportunity for young women to learn about the varied understandings of feminism, to share struggles and discuss strategies of resistance, and create solidarity among young feminists in Canada. The gathering will be held in Winnipeg from May 20th to 23rd. For more information, go to rebels.org.
The Ginger Project is a group of both NDP and non-NDP party members formed 2 years ago to reintroduce socialist ideals into the Canadian political landscape. On May 28th, this group will host a convention to establish a Socialist Party of Ontario. The Ginger Project encourages all those opposed to neoliberalism, racism, sexism, homophobia, and who support an egalitarian society based on principles of justice and fairness to attend. The convention will be held at the Bond Place Hotel in Toronto. For more information, go to thegingerproject.org.
That's all for Around the Left for the week of April 28th, 2011.
Twitter, Facebook, and viral Get Out the Vote campaigns have added an interesting dimension to the federal election campaign of 2011. What overall effect is this new technology having on the voting process, and will democracy be the key beneficiary? To speak to this phenomenon, Alert is joined on the phone by Antonia Zerbisius. Antonia is a social commentator and writer for the Toronto Star. So thanks for joining us, Antonia.
Thank you, Michael.
So what, in your view, are the principal factors that are shaping this new technology that seems to be overcoming traditional youth apathy?
Well, that's three questions in one. Okay. And one was a technological question that I can't answer because I don't understand the technology of it. I just know how it sort of affects things. And the second question you asked me is how is shaping the youth vote, or shall we say uprising? So I'll get to that in a second. In terms of Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, I have to say that I have, you know, in my previous incarnations at the Star, most of that time, 18 years, was as a media or television columnist. And, you know, most of that coverage was focused on mainstream media, newspapers, and television. And I have never had so much fun as I am having during this federal election, because you can get right into the ring and come out swinging. And actually, it's not a one-way street anymore. You don't have to wait for the national at 10 o'clock. You don't have to sit there through the weather or the entertainment reports on News World or CBC News Network, as they're calling it now. You can just ignore everybody and everything and not only help inform your community members, and by community members I mean your friends on Facebook, the people who follow you, and people who follow certain, as they say, hashtags or channels, and the one that's being commonly used right now is ELXN41 for the 41st election. So you can really shape perceptions out there. You can change the course, assuming you have enough followers and a great enough reach, change the course of the conversation. And, for example, I mean, this was not intentional, really, I'm saying, on the surface, but at the beginning of the campaign, I wrote a very lengthy feature for the Toronto Star outlining all the different ways that the Harper government has not been good for women, from funding cuts to maternal health care to all of that. And that story got a lot of traction through Twitter and Facebook and gave rise to a hashtag called FemVote. Which means that women are increasingly, and women are younger women are increasingly getting involved. And interestingly, I noticed that in all the those youth mob, student mob vote videos coming out of the universities, every single one has been organized by a young woman, and the women dominate in the crowds. So is there a and then there's also that whole string of YouTube videos of it's over, Steve, we're breaking up, Steve, it's not you, it's me, or it's me, or it's not you, whatever. And it's coming from women and young women. So if I see any tendency in terms of the youth vote, it is coming from young women because they feel disenfranchised as youth and they are angry as women.
Okay, so you seem to be, I was going to ask if there's anything inherent about these technologies that would compel democratic participation. And what I'm hearing from you is the instantaneous nature of it and the ability of people to interact as opposed to just wait for the evening news.
Well, there's the instantaneous, there's the interaction, there's the back and forth, because you don't just interact with the news organizations and the journalists and the politicians, because some of them do interact with readers or viewers, not that many. David Aiken from Sun Media, Katie O'Malley from CBC interacts somewhat, Susan Delacorte of the Toronto Star interacts, and I interact. So there's a little bit of interaction from journalists. There's a little bit of interaction from politicians. But I think that the real thing that's going on is the feeling that you are not just standing there watching the parade go by, that you can become part of the parade. And not only is that empowering, it's fun. I was telling some, on Easter Sunday, I was telling my family, you know, because they mock me for being on social media all the time, and I said, I feel like I'm playing this fantastic video game that could influence what happens in this country. And it really is the most apt description I can think of.
Antonio, is there a political party that is benefiting from this, as far as you could tell?
Yes, absolutely. No, let me rephrase that. It's it's the one political party that is not benefiting from it, and that is the conservatives. And that is because, you know, the conservatives have the upper hand, right? They've got the instruments of power. They've got the money. They've got they come from a position of power and authority. And they're the ones who have to be, you know, in the minds of many, many, many voters, knocked off, you know, the top of the mountain kind of thing. So because people who support the Liberals or the NDP or the Green or the Bloc don't come from that top of the mountain thing, like they're trying to scale that hill and take that hill, they're benefiting the most from it because they are using the tools most often. So even if, and I have, even if you conduct extensive searches on YouTube and elsewhere looking for anything that's pro-Harper that isn't released by the party itself, you are going to have a very hard time finding anything, whereas there is an explosion of creative talent being directed at toppling the conservative government.
What you're saying is very interesting, because Stephen Harper has become quite renowned for his being a quote-unquote control freak, or at least that's his reputation, right?
Right.
And it seems as if this technology, if I'm hearing you correctly, kind of defies the ability to be controlled. No one can control it.
Well, it defies authority, period, right? It doesn't just defy party politics. It also defies media. There is no more control. You cannot, in the mainstream media, cannot set the agenda anymore. In fact, they are following the agenda. I am getting stories off Twitter. For example, there was this little scandal. I don't know if it reached out your way in Winnipeg, but it was this little scandal in Toronto over the weekend about a Liberal candidate removing Green Party flyers from the mailboxes of voters in his riding and substituting the flyers with Liberal flyers. I picked that off. Twitter, somebody who was just an ordinary person, noticed it on the street, started taking pictures, posted it on Tumblr. Next thing you know, 3 days later, it's in the Toronto Star.
Now, that gets to another question. As a journalist, you're aware of how the internet has brought more information to the fingertips of the populace, but it's also enabled the spreading of misinformation and improperly sourced facts. So I'm wondering if you see a comparable downside to this social networking, these social networking tools where elections are concerned.
Yeah, well, so far, to my knowledge, there hasn't been anything like that in terms of the election. You know, there's been a few incidents in which the celebrities have been declared dead when they aren't dead. But the wonderful thing about this sort of this technology is that it's correcting. It's crowd correcting. So if you were to tweet something that was wrong, and I look at it and I go, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. Are you kidding? You know, I would check it out, and I wouldn't be the only one checking it out. And there would be some people who would mindlessly retweet it or repeat it or post it on their Facebook or whatever. But then there would be a lot of other people who would go, you know what, I'm going to check this out. So eventually it becomes self-correcting. And that can be minutes or even an hour or so. I've posted mistaken tweets about various subjects, and I've gone back to correct them because next thing I knew, I'm not talking about the election. I'm talking about things that are not that critical. People come back at me and go, no, that's wrong. And next thing I know, I'm saying, oh, sorry about that last tweet. My bad. I got it wrong. It should be like this, you know, and I'm going to take down that tweet. So please be aware.
Well, Antonia, we're at the end of our time. I want to thank you for sharing those rather profound thoughts about us as we are entering the final lap of this election.
Oh, this weekend's going to be wild. I can hardly wait.
Okay. Well, we'll be looking forward to your tweets and blogs and whatnot.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you. And that was Antonia Zerbesius. She is a social commentator and writer for the Toronto Star. There has been widespread disbelief of the rise of the NDP as a political force in Quebec. Is it a temporary blip or a historical turning point? For his insight into these questions, Alert turns to Pierre Baudet, founder of Quebec NGO Alternative and editor of the Nouveau Cahier du Socialisme. Pierre Baudet, what's behind the surprising and unprecedented NDP surge in Quebec?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of reasons, good reasons and not so good reasons. On the positive side, there's definitely here a surge to the left, which was noticeable for the last few months, mostly around Quebec Solidaire and the capacity of that political formation and social movements to present an alternative. So the urban rumor, so to speak, is that a lot of these Quebec Solidaire supporters are going to the NDP, and a lot also from social movements and whatnot. I think the NDP message was smooth, was sympathetic, was positive, and it was attractive to that kind of population here that is not so small. Because if you look at the total numbers, the Bloc and the NDP are way ahead of the Conservatives and the Liberals. And the Bloc and NDP have a quite similar program. It's just that the NDP at this point might appear new and more attractive, and the Bloc is a bit, you know, behind. So I feel that from a left point of view, this is positive. Now, there's a negative side, because NDP votes will neutralize Bloc votes. And such is the lousy electoral system in Canada, winner takes all.
First past the post. Is what
so it means that in many ridings where the Bloc is ahead, they might lose to the NDP, leaving the Liberals and the Conservatives to squeeze in. It's exactly that situation in my riding, which is called Hounsic, north of Montreal. And for the last two mandates, it was a progressive Bloc woman. She got it with a few hundred votes of majority. And so I'm afraid that if some of these voters go to NDP, you know, the Liberal, in this case, it's the Liberal rather than the Conservative, who will win. And so this is the situation in Quebec, where many ridings are at stake. And it might, it's a paradox, but, you know, it comes from the system we have. It's a paradox, but the right wing might be benefiting. And so that's why you hear a lot of the conservative commentators and experts on the media. I mean, people who have been traditionally associated with the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party are very now enamored with the NDP.
Okay.
It's hypocritical.
Yeah.
But at the same time, their calculation is that, finally, the Bloc can be beaten.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. If does this signal the beginning of the end of the Bloc? Or are we talking, is this a sort of like a temporary love affair, or is this something that could endure? Or are we looking at a more fundamental changing of the political landscape in Quebec?
Well, it's a bit, you know, there are many interpretations. My interpretation is that, no, the Bloc and the PQ, they are twins, are there to remain. They are remaining, but are becoming relatively weaker. And at the provincial level, Quebec Solidaire is on the rise, the PQ is stagnating, and I think it reflects the situation. But to say that the PQ and the Bloc will, you know, go down and down, I think it's very premature for many reasons. First of all, as I said, I don't believe that the NDP is ready to crack the system in a big-time way. And so we will have a right-wing government. And what will it do, this right-wing government? It will be very threatening and whatnot. The Bloc has been historically capable of opposing it. Mm-hmm. They are like a grain of sand in the gear. They are not proposing, but they are opposing quite effectively.
Okay,
people
then,
know that.
Well, what about the liberals then? I mean, they seem to be...
The liberals are out.
They're
out. The liberals have been losing to the right, to the conservative, of course. They've been losing to the left, to the NDP. The liberals are in disarray. And the Liberal Party in Quebec, the Federal Liberal Party in Quebec, is split between two factions fighting one another. And on the one side, you have the old Trudeauist hardliner, the anti-nationalist, I call them the obsessive one. And then you have a more toned-down, modernized version. So they're really in the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
They've been losing also with immigrant communities, just the same like everywhere else in Canada, where the immigrants who used to be almost clients of the Liberal Party now are much more diversified politically. They have not gained with the Francophones. They have with the Anglophones. I think that's what remains with the Liberal Party in Quebec. 15% of the population who will vote for the Liberal until death.
Well, the hardliners, I guess you might say. But our impression out here in the West that is that the downfall of the Liberals was largely triggered by the sponsorship scandal, and yet they brought in Ignatieff, and
it's more structural than that. It was aggravated by the sponsorship scandal. But if you look at the evolution and the numbers over the last 20 years, you see a decline. But it became dramatic with the sponsorship. I see the sponsorship as the trigger, not as the fundamental cause.
Okay.
Because the Liberals were caught between their sort of centrist position, semi-Keynesian tradition, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the policies that they imposed under Chrétien and Paul Martin, which were very similar to the Conservatives. So ordinary working people, middle class, as we call it in this country, started to wonder what's for us.
So
and elites have turned very much to the Conservatives. So they've been squeezed on both sides. It's a general phenomenon that you can observe in many capitalist countries where the centrist parties are on the decline.
So does that mean that so you don't see the Liberals recovering?
Well, never say never, but at this point it would be a big surprise. If there is a collapse, by the way, I don't know if that was discussed in Canada, but I think there might be another idea up in the air, which could be a rapprochement between the NDP and the Liberals to recreate a sort of center, very mildly left formation. It's not unthinkable because the Liberals will admit that they're going to go down, and the NDP will consider that they're not never going to be able to win an election without enlarging their base. So I'm speculating here, but I wouldn't be surprised of such a twist. It depends, of course, on the results in May 2. If the NDP makes it so big, they might be in a better position to say we are the alternative.
So, as far as Quebec is concerned, should the NDP be, if they wish to have staying power, should they just try to take over the middle ground ceded by the Liberals, or this? I think what you're talking about, a merger with the Liberals,
yeah.
Would that give them the clout they need to potentially
a merge or a very strong coalition? But careful, Quebec is not the same. I feel that the search for the NDP is fragile here. It's more by default, all right, by a sort of distanciation from what are considered the traditional parties, including the Bloc. It remains to be seen how stable it will be, because the nationalist appeal is not just a spin here. It is based on historical and structural reasons, and it will come back. And Jack Layton, in this campaign, has been very silent on these things. I think it was his choice, his policy, to remain silent. But it will come back like a vengeance, meaning some of the economic and political battle lines between the federal government and the Quebec nation and the Quebec state not just the Bloc and not just the Parti Québécois. You have many, many issues. You have a total unanimity in Quebec against the attempts by the federal government to push Quebec around. And so we will see what Jack will be able to do on these issues. He has been silent on this.
Okay. Well, Pierre Baudet, I want to thank you very much for helping bring some fresh insights into this bizarre dynamic that's unraveling over the course of this election. So thank you very much for joining us on Alert.
Thank you.
And that was Pierre Baudet. He is the founder of Quebec NGO, the Quebec NGO Alternative, and editor of the Nouveau Cahier du Socialisme. In the following interview, recorded on the occasion of the recent Cochabamba Plus One climate conference in Montreal, Stefan Christoff, an organizer with Tadamon, asked Patrick Bond, an academic with the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, about the upcoming UN climate conference in Durban, South Africa, and to put that international gathering in the context of previous summits on climate and the economy.
One of the things we always have to do is reality check and ask whether the group that's going to come, including the Canadian government, has any interest or capacity to solve this huge problem, given the terribly adverse balance of forces. Not just that it's a Tory government with a lot of climate denialism and is kind of following the lead of the United States that's just absolutely, you know, sort of gridlocked in legislative terms, and is so heavily influenced by projects like tar sands and shale gas and all the rest. But actually, there's a bigger problem, I think, Stefan, that the world elites, since meeting in the city, I think really in 1987 in the Montreal Protocol that dealt with chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, that are increasing the size of the ozone hole. And so having finally at that point said, okay, we'll put a cap on that and prevent these CFCs, starting in 1996, they were banned. That was really the last time, I think, that these global elites have done anything to solve a global problem properly. And the major challenges of the period since, the neoliberalism and neoconservatism ideologically that have come up in the 90s and 2000s, the attempts to change the Bretton Woods institutions, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, pretty much no change there. World Trade Organization is, you know, in a cul-de-sac, so it's going nowhere. The UN Security Council and United Nations processes are stuck, and aid is not flowing. And you come to you know, geopolitics and the wars that are still raging in Central Asia and the Middle East and now North Africa. You know, these are big, big problems that these elites have no capacity to deal with. And the climate is just the latest in that. And since Kyoto, where they had a ridiculous idea to solve the problem with the market, with the carbon trading, and they had very limited objectives, 5% cuts by 2012 from 1990 levels, we really have seen our world elites just absolutely fail to come properly to any of these tables and solve the problems. So let's say Durban will be a continuation. Copenhagen was more of a disaster for them for public relations reasons. And then in Cancun, they were able to pretend that they are back on track, as we know they sort of are building a castle in the sky of market solutions and on quicksand. The markets are actually absolutely failing. The European carbon market was absolutely stymied by hacking and theft. You know, a couple of 3 months ago was actually shut down, and the U.S. has gone nowhere. California might get up and running, but there's a lawsuit that just was filed by environmental justice activists in San Francisco to stop that, and nowhere else really can we find. I mean, Montreal's a pathetic little market. There's nothing really going on to give any sense that the biggest problem we'll ever face, I think, the climate problem in our lifetimes, is going to be solved through their ideal solution, a carbon market. And it's such a tragedy, I must just say, that the Greens and the NDP and the, you know, all of the opposition parties in this country are all for carbon trading. It's absurd. It just makes one think that what we'd normally expect from sort of rational middle-class Canadian elites, you know, with leadership like Stephen Lewis used to provide on the AIDS battle, is actually not there. They're definitely Canadians part of the problem. And that maybe brings me to Durban, because I think if Canadians mm-hmm. come with Washington, with Obama's people and the World Bank and the EU. You know, Connie Hedegaard's obviously shown as a Danish leader she can't do anything on climate. And then the Japanese and the Russians have just said they're pulling out of Kyoto. We're really looking at the major bloc of northern negotiators totally sabotaging any possibility. And that, in turn, means for activists a pretty easy argument that these guys just shouldn't come. You know, if there's going to be a conference of the party 17, COP 17, and the Canadians come, and the Yankees, and the Russians, and the Japanese, and the Europeans, well, it'll just be a conference of polluters. It's not going to actually solve the problem. So one of the arguments then, and I think we were getting a sense of this in the World Social Forum when we last talked, is that the Canadian government should stay home, and the Canadian people who care about the climate have a responsibility to begin to ask, well, what are these delegates doing in our name? And there's certainly enough evidence from the Bangkok preparatory meeting in early April, and there will be in the June meeting in Bonn, that Canadian delegates are absolutely saboteurs and just shouldn't be allowed to come to Durban. And that might mean people using the old spirit of Mahatma Gandhi and sit-ins and satyagraha and sort of civil disobedience to prevent that. And I think that's going to be the kind of message that's going to reverberate around the world.
Kristoff then asked Bond to comment on his expectations going into the Durban conference.
The debate now in Durban that I've just come from, in fact, is the extent to which we can build a big united movement to link the traditional maybe centrist NGOs that do work on environment, like WWF and some of those groups in the Climate Action Network, which is more the establishment insider negotiating, who are often in favor of carbon trading and market sort of supposed solutions on the one hand, and with the CJ, the climate justice movements of South Africa. We have a climate justice now in South Africa that's disparate, has in the three different big cities, Durban the second biggest, Joburg the biggest, Cape Town third, very strong activists, probably about 25, 30 in each, that have built up different projects and different protests that suggest we can probably host something quite useful if we put all of our efforts together, including on December 3rd, a big march, sort of united march with unifying demands. And that means that our alternative summit space, which we anticipate, it's not 100%, but I anticipate it will be at the Durban University of Technology, whose chancellor, incidentally, is actually the granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi, her name Ella Gandhi. And as we speak today, she just held a salt march with several thousand people, sort of recreating that spirit of Gandhi. And I think that satyagraha center that she has and the spirit there of commitment to civil disobedience, we'll see some evidence of then in Durban. And I think that's going to be a really good space. It's much closer to the ICC, the International Conference Center, the Convention Center, than some of the other venues. And as a result, we'll probably get also a lot of flow through of ordinary people from Durban. It's a very right next to the big transport center. And I think actually it'll be a terrific space for a week and a half or two, starting in November 28th. There may be some other big teach-ins, and of course we're doing climate camps leading up to that. So I do expect a good alternative summit space. It might be called a climate in Daba. I think Klima Forum is a sort of spirit from Copenhagen's effort, but we'll have a South African name in Daba, I suspect. And I think that'll be an all-in kind of thing, and the public certainly very open, and maybe some good debates between the different ideological positions while we get ourselves educated about what it is. My own hope is climate justice comes out very strongly and with a very strong militant march, and it may be a march. I think we should certainly march away from this International Convention Center, where I don't think anything useful will happen, and in disgust basically say this is the elites failing yet again. We've actually now got to do something more serious. More serious climate politics means we have to go to the sites of huge emissions, and in Durban that's going to be the big petrochemical complex, the biggest set of oil refineries south of the Niger Delta, plus the airport, plus the dozens of other sites of potential. We have, for example, a big clean development mechanism. And virtually all the people that are part of that hosting committee, a group called the C17, 17 people from different organizations, I think are going to be very strongly on board for finding sites where we really put our bodies on the line and say that, like we've seen in Alberta and with the tar sands, and in Quebec with the fights against shale gas, we really need the grassroots to take the lead, because the world elites are making a terrible mess.
We just heard Patrick Bond of the University of KwaZulu-Natal speaking to Stefan Christoff on the background to the upcoming climate conference in Durban.
This is Music is a Weapon. I'm Mitch Podolik. And on this week's show, a retrospective of a very, very fine political folk artist by the name of Hazel Dickens. Some of you may have seen her in the movie Matawan, which was about the mine struggle in West Virginia in the 20s. Every time they needed somebody to come up and sing a really sorrowful tune, they get Hazel to do it. She was one of the most absolutely finest political thinkers that I ever met out of the Southern Mountains. She was a great singer of traditional songs, and she was a great singer of minor songs. And she sang about the conflicts that people had in the South and the mountain people had. When we lost Hazel last week, a real great part of the folk community died. She's a wonderful... So for those of you who never heard her, you're about to have a real treat and about to be introduced to a great artist. And for those of you who knew Hazel, sorry about that, folks, but here she is. But through the wonderful media recordings, we'll have Hazel forever. Here she is with Fire in the Hole.
You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, load another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole. Daddy died a miner, Grandpa he did too. I'll bet this coal will kill me before my working days is through. In a hole that's dark and dirty, an early grave confined, I plan to make a union for the ones I leave behind. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. Far in our hearts and far in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no far in the hole. There ain't gonna be no far in the hole. side of my head. Let by the number nine code. Let by the number nine code. Well, someday when I'm dead and gone, heaven, the land of my dreams, I won't have to worry about losing my job, hard times and big machines. Won't have to pay my money away on dues and hospital plans. I'm gonna cut coal where the blue heavens roll. Sang with the angel band. Sang with the angel band. Well, I'm traveling on down that coal town road. Listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye, White Sycamore. I'm leaving you behind.
That was Coal Tattoo, written by Billy Ed Wheeler. And before that, Fire in the Hole, all sung by the late, great Hazel Dickens. The thing about Hazel is that she connected in both as a country singer and an old-time singer and a mountain singer, and she really had all those kind of different kinds of skills. But the thing that really characterized her was her real affinity for, dare I use the word, proletarian, for proletarian art. She was absolutely connected to the society that she was part of, through the good times and the bad times. Here again is Hazel Dickens with Aragon Mill.
There's a chimney so tall that says Aragon Mill. But there's no smoke at all coming out of the stack, for the mill has pulled out and it ain't coming back. And the is the cry of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. There's no children at all in the narrow, empty streets. Since the loons have all gone, it's so quiet I can't sleep. Now I'm too old to change, and I'm too young to die, and there's no place to go for my old man and I. And the only sound I hear is the cry of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. Yes, the only sound I hear is the cry of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. Yes, the only sound I hear is the cry of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin. United we stand, divided we fall. For every dime they give us, a battle must be fought. So working people, use your power, the key to liberty. Don't support that rich man style of luxury.
And there ain't no way they can ever keep us down. Oh no, ain't no way they
that can ever keep us down.
We won't be bought, we won't be sold, to be treated right, well that's our goal.
And there ain't no way that can ever keep us down.
We've been shot, we've been jailed, Lord, it's a sin. Women and little children stood right by the men. But we got a union contract that keeps the worker free, and I'll never shoot that union out of me.
They'll never shoot that union out of me, oh no. Never shoot that union out of me.
Got a contract in her hand signed by the blood of honest men,
and they'll never shoot that union out of me.
Was Hazel Dickens, the late Hazel Dickens, with They'll Never Keep Us Down, and before that, Aragon Mill. What a loss to folk music, what a loss to the class struggle. That's it for this week, folks. See you next week.
Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for being with us. Please join us next week for our final show of the season, which will feature a review of the past federal election by members of the Canadian Dimension Collective, including Leo Panitch, David McNally, Andrea Levy, Judy Rebick, Marie Dobbin, and James Laxer, among others. If you'd like to send us a comment, write to alert@canadiandimension.com. To hear this show again, or to hear any of our past shows, go to the Canadian Dimension website at canadiandimension.com and select Alert. The show is also podcast on rabble.ca.
The executive producer of Alert is Canadian Dimension publisher Cy Gonick. Technical producer is Tommy Allen, assisted by Selena Surik. Alert headlines by Chris Webb. Around the Left, prepared by Ben Wood. Music is The Weapon by Mitch Podolak. I'm Ashley Titterton.
And I'm Michael Welsh. Alert Radio is a production of Canadian Dimension magazine.
Est-ce que ça va?